Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored by the hilarious party game Utter Nonsense. Now, have you ever wondered what it's like to see your friend orgasm or take a poop? Reveal these mysteries and more with the Chicago-born party game Utter Nonsense, currently available at Target stores nationwide. Check it out at utternonsensegame.com. That's utternonsensegame.com. This episode is also sponsored by the 7th Annual Dallas Comedy Festival, and they're officially open for submissions. If you're a stand-up, improv team, or sketch troupe, you can save $15 off your submission fee if you register before November 10th. The festival takes place March 23rd through the 26th in warm and sunny Dallas, Texas. This year promises to be bigger and better than ever before. Visit DallasComedyFestival.com for more information. That's Dallas Comedy Festival. Also, don't forget to check out my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, and see why Chicago Magazine said I'm one of the five people to study comedy with in Chicago. Also, my brand new book is out, The Inner Game of Improv, Five Steps to Getting Bigger in Your Improv Career. This is a great book if you're feeling stuck and you want an even bigger improv career. It's only $3.99 and it's a very short read. You can pick it up on Amazon as an ebook, or you can get it as a PDF off my website. For class information of The Art of Slow Comedy and my book, go to my slick new website. That's JimmyCorain.com. JimmyCorain.com. Guess what? Guess what I have for you? You got it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Jen Ellison. She is a performer, writer, teacher, and director. She is best known for the director of the ETC show here, the Second City ETC show, The Grapes of Wrath. She teaches at the Second City Training Center. She's also a teacher at the Comedy Studies program at Columbia College and at DePaul University. We talked to Jen about how she developed a passion for directing at a very young age, and how she graduated from the DePaul Theater School, a very serious theater program, and she found herself doing comedy sport, and also why it is so important for her to admit when she makes a mistake when she's directing. Now, before we get to the episode with Jen, I haven't brought this up on the podcast in a while, and that is the status of my father. The status is he is still dying. He's 80 and he's got this lung disease and his breathing is starting to really go. He's hooked up on oxygen. And as you know, I am trying to repair my relationship with my dad. I've worked on my resentments towards him. And the last time I went to go see him was about a month ago. And I asked him what I could do to help him prepare for his death. And at the time, he didn't know what to say or what he wanted. And just recently, I got an email from him because I'm going to see him this Monday. And he said what he'd like is for me to make him laugh now and until he goes. And I've got to tell you something. I'm feeling a little pressure. I don't know what to do in terms of that. Now, growing up, I was the fat kid in the family who, in a very, very dysfunctional family that always made, you know, the family laugh. During the pain that we had, and we had a lot of pain and a lot of dysfunction in our family, I was the one who always was making people laugh, especially my parents, because that's how I got attention. That and if I got in trouble. Those were the two things that were always a sure way of me getting attention. So it's come full circle for me. I'm back in my role as the jester, the one to make the family laugh. And like I said, I got a lot of pressure on that. All right, enough about me. You're going to love this episode with Jen Ellison, especially the improv scene. She's an amazing improviser. She brings a lot of acting and an emotional level to it. And we get into a very interesting discussion about tone, what somebody is saying on stage, right? What the character is saying on stage, because a lot of times we just say yes immediately. But if you listen for the tone, it can give you even more clues on what direction the scene could go in. So here it is. You're going to love it. The Jen Ellison episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd.
I am so happy I am so happy. You said you were nervous back there to do this.
Yeah.
What were you nervous about?
Failure.
Okay.
I think that's what I'm always afraid of.
But you also embrace failure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure. I wonder if sometimes I kind of artificially kind of jack myself up because I want to be nervous, or I'm just, I don't know.
Are you nervous now, or were you just nervous backstage?
Nervous backstage. I'm anxious now, but I mean, yeah.
Okay, so let's go. Thank you for your honesty. You grew up in a small town of 5,000 people.
Yeah.
In Black Mountain, North Carolina.
Yes.
You described yourself as a hillbilly, is that right?
Oh, yeah, I did. Yes.
You are a hillbilly?
I am a hillbilly.
What is your definition of a hillbilly?
Well, I mean, I think that I just, I literally grew up on a mountain.
Okay.
Like, I lived on Allen Mountain. And it's not like there was nobody else around. But we definitely were, you know, we're in the Appalachians, so it's very, it's pretty rural, and I used to have a super, super thick sort of mountain-type accent, and then it kind of dropped away.
And you said you wanted to grow up, you wanted to be either a bank teller or a scarecrow. can you explain?
Those were the yeah, I did. that seemed like I would put Tinker Toys in my pants and walk around
as a scarecrow.
As a scarecrow, okay. Because I my favorite movie was The Wizard of Oz, and so I looked at the scarecrow and thought that is the career for me.
What was it about a scarecrow that you?
Well, I liked that he was he seemed to solve a lot of problems. He was friendly. He was a good manager, I thought. I don't know. He just seemed like very like homey and sweet to somebody who was from out of town, so to speak. And then the bank teller thing was just like I imagine myself wearing like a pencil skirt with like a boat like one of those big kind of fluffy 1970s bow ties. And a blouse, and everything was brown, and I just worked it. Like, I figured that's what you did when you grew up. You worked as a bank teller.
So at 11 years old, you performed for the first time in community theater. Mm-hmm. What changes?
I was Oliver in our community theater production of Oliver.
Oliver, like the musical Oliver?
Yes.
The food, glorious food.
Yes, exactly.
Please, sir, could I have some more?
Yes, that Oliver? Yeah, that one, yes. Okay. And that was my, yeah.
Who did you play?
I played Oliver.
Oh, my God.
I was Oliver Twist. I was the titular Oliver.
And then there was all these other community theater people, right?
Yeah. It was the first thing I ever really did. I think I saw the previous year's production of Sound of Music. And, her name was Kimberly. I saw her on the stage. I was like, what is she doing? And I was like, I'm gonna do that.
What do you mean? What was she doing?
I was like, what? I should be doing that.
Like you were jealous of what?
Totally.
She was, yeah.
I was like, what is she? What? That's my light. And I was in the audience. So, so yeah, I was like, I wanted to do that. And so as soon as I saw her, I was I auditioned for. I sang Happy Birthday. And got cast as Oliver.
How did you get over? Like, I see all these people from North Carolina, the Black Mountains. Like, how did they get the English part down?
Because actually, a Southern accent is not very different than a British accent. It's just a slowed down British accent.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm an amateur dialectician.
Right. Then in high school, you continue this, you get more involved in theater, mm-hmm. and you start doing plays, and your high school drama teacher was Peggy Boring.
Yes.
And did she get made fun of with the name Boring?
Weirdly, no. Because we just called her PB.
Okay.
And she was a pretty visionary woman. We would do contest plays, and she would do these cutting.
What's contest plays?
So, like, we would go to the North Carolina Theater Conference, and it's like a high school where you have they have these bizarre arbitrary rules where it's like, you have 45 minutes, build a set, do your show, strike your set, you are over that line at the end of your 45 minutes, and if you're not, then you're out, and you don't get any awards or anything, and you're shamed. Like, it was like that, and it was really hardcore, and we would do these cuttings of, 45-minute versions of the plays.
You'd condense them to 45 minutes.
Yes, and the ones that we did... We did El Emocionario by Lee Blessing one year that I was doing it. She would do, she did a cutting of Our Town, I believe, that my sister was also in. So my sister was in, my older sister Amy was in that theater program. So that was also kind of my entry point as well. And so we would do those plays. Then we'd also do forensics. Then we'd do the high school. We would do a musical. And it was... she was very challenging to us. There was never an easy, like, we're going to do Hello, Dolly, or we're going to do The Odd Couple. It was, let's do a play that is that has a lot of darkness to it and a lot of challenge, and that is, you know, we did a version of The Diviners one year, which is about sort of religious fervor and how it winds up with the murder of a boy, and like, or accidental death of a boy, I should say. And there was a lot of stuff that was kind of sticky for high school students to be doing. But she was so creative, we had no money. We had nothing. It was one of the, I think, probably one of the best programs in the state, because she was just so driven towards, let's make this theater happen, even in the face of people who didn't necessarily want it to happen.
And then she does a production with you, Independence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it featured suicide and a gay characters. And because of that, they transferred her out of the school. How did you, I mean, you looked up to her, I would imagine, mm-hmm. and she was a mentor of yours, probably.
Yeah.
How did you, as a kid, process that?
It was sort of a long, I think that, like, and I want to make sure I'm also, like, remembering that correctly, like, that was part of the straw that broke the camel's back, because she was kind of a buck the system type of person. And... I think I internalized it a lot. I have sort of a polarized feeling, I guess, which is, like, there's part of me that's like, I'm a rule follower and make sure everybody's okay. And then there's the other part of me that's like, ah, fuck the rules. You know, like, that. There's a little bit of that. So there was, on one end, I was like, I understood why it wound up happening because of sort of the cumulative effect of her being very challenging with her material and a lot of her choices. And then on the other end of it, sort of being like, well, we need to be challenged. You know, the students need to be challenged. I don't think this stuff was that inappropriate for a high school audience. Now, in 1992, that was in North Carolina in a tiny little town. I mean, I'm sure that there was a little bit like, you know, why are they talking about that? You know, like, there was a little bit of that, but it was very... and it was a very conservative Christian area. So I understand, you know, their hesitance about it, but, you know, we need to be challenged by our material.
Why is it important to be
challenged?
Yes.
It enlivens the mind. Like, there's study after study that shows that this is the case, that we can't, if we're just in our own little bubble where we're absolutely positive that our audience is going to agree with us, then it just creates this echo chamber where, you know, nothing really grows or changes, and you become very comfortable in your opinions. And comfort doesn't breed anything except for just more comfort and then some pretty insidious behavior. So, and you just, so I think that to be challenged and to help define your ideas and opinions and make sure that things are, you know, I guess, evidence-based, and make sure that you're not just sort of coasting along, I think it stunts your growth if you're just comfortable and just being agreed with all the time.
So you then graduate from high school, and you go to the DePaul Theater School, mm-hmm. which is a very competitive program. Mm-hmm. And in the first year, I found this amazing, you don't touch a script, you only do Viola Spolin improv games.
Yes.
What was that like?
Amazing. I'm not sure if that's what the program is like now, because it's been a while, so it's possible that it has changed. But when I was there, our acting class was... I remember it being three times a week, but it might have been two times a week. It was like at least twice a week, 3 hours, hardcore Viola Spolin stuff. So like you are going to pick up that mug and you are going to make sure that it looks like it's got fluid in it. And I want to know, it's a ceramic mug versus just a plastic mug, or is it a travel mug? Like, I mean, everything
was
very... Yeah, oh, yeah, go
that's
ahead.
After we were walking around space for an hour.
Like, you know, transformations
right.
all that stuff, which, like, I was just like, you know, if blood we rolling out of my ears, because I was just like, this is infuriating.
You hated it, right, at the beginning?
At the beginning, I think everybody does, because you're just like, I'm going in thick space, and I'm going to, oh, and here's a rake, I guess. You know, like there's a lot of...
Right. Are you sure that's a rake?
Maybe it's a rake, but also maybe it's a quarter staff.
Oh, like, great. I thought it was a giant spoon.
It could have been a giant spoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Right.
Right. Yes.
Right.
So there was a lot of...
So you were going out of your mind during this, right?
Yeah, during it. It was also very... It's very meditative. Also, when you're 18 and you're just like, I don't like... I don't like doing anything. Like, there was a little bit of that, of me kind of being stubborn. But I also enjoyed the pretending of, like, playing with those objects and... So I became kind of an object work nerd. Maybe that will be my
what
podcast.
What is that? Yeah, yeah. Believe me, there's a big enough audience for it. So when you say you're a nerd about object work, what do you mean by that?
I would go... Okay, so we could reserve rooms in the school. I would...
Like one of those little... An actual, like classroom?
Yes.
Okay.
I would reserve a room, and I would go in there with a notebook, and I would sit and be like, okay, so... A table is usually about this high. So if I wanted to, like, set something on the table, I would have to make sure that I would reach down and make sure what kind of bag I had. Did I open it up? What kind of, like, how would it, what's the quality of the bag? Pick up something, put it on the table, and make sure that it's there. And, like, I would sit there and measure places on my body where certain things were so I could have consistency of space.
What's the difference between a nerd and a compulsion?
That's a very good question. I think it was compulsive. It was compulsive. But then I would have, I think what makes it nerddom is if you meet somebody else who is also like, yeah. And then the two of you can create nerd culture surrounding. And there were other people who were like, can I come in there with you sometime and do it? So we
and what would you guys do then?
We weren't drinking. what would we do? Sometimes we would just improvise together in the room and, like, really try to make sure that we engaged with an environment or with a space or, you know, something like that. And then try not to ask questions about what we were, or just talk about what we were doing.
I love object work, and I've gotten lazy over the years. Why is the object work still important in improv?
It gives shape to the scene in a way that just sitting and talking does not. Now, object work is not just like picking up a cup or a pen. It's also engaging in the environment and really seeing it or having a response to it. So it is having a location. We're not all doing scenes in the Mac PC commercial world where it's just white background and that's it. Like, it's, you're in a location. If you're a human being on the planet, you are in a place. And to have that space defined for you gives shape to it. And I think one of the examples that I like to use is if you are having a breakup scene outside of a bar at 2 a.m., that's one thing. If it's a breakup scene outside of a, or inside of a wedding chapel just before, like as the couple is walking down the aisle and you're sitting in the pew, like that's a whole different thing. And how the objects of, like, you know, the pew itself, sitting in it, what it's like to be there and be sort of surrounded by other people, having that environment shapes that scene in a way that just, like, well, we're going to have a breakup scene, and it's super general. We are people in locations, and those locations help define the people that we are.
Also, you, at this time, you knew at a very young age that you wanted to be a director. Mm-hmm. So why were you taking acting classes?
I think it was two reasons. I think first was I wanted to make sure that I knew what that was like and continue to develop my... So I could speak to actors and be able to get a good performance out of them in a like sympathetic, compassionate way so that it wasn't just me being like, do this, go there.
You knew you were going to experience what they were going
through. Right. So there was that. And I think that on the other end of it, like, I don't think I really got that there was any other way I could go except for through acting, because that at least, because they didn't, there weren't a lot of BFA programs for directors.
Do you remember the first time you realized I want to be a director and how old you were?
I think I was like 16 when it really sort of occurred to me. And then I had my improv group in high school that I made called the Fastidious Flying Aardvarks. And we were so terrible.
How bad were you?
We were so bad. It was just like, I mean, short actually, you know what? They were good. Yeah, it was short form games.
Okay.
I watched Comedy Sports come to a theater festival once, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's fun. And then I modified some of those games, but I was a terrible director of that. I was just sort of like, it was more of, be funnier. Don't, you know, there was a lot of no in my direction. Right. Like, because, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I think I have a rule book for the Fastidious Flying Aardvarks. It was just like a handbook. And like, if you read it, it's just like, it is the most gut-churningly.
Do you remember one thing you said that you're like embarrassed to tell us about?
Oh, gosh. It was like, I think it was something along the lines of, if a scene isn't going well, like, fall down and die, or do, like, it was like, make some kind of weird arbitrary Deus Ex Machina type, like, you know, oh my gosh, aliens, like, everything that you're not supposed to do. Like, it wasn't explore and heighten, it right. was...
A piano's going to fall down.
Right. Yeah.
React to the piano. Yeah. Why didn't you react to the piano?
Yes. It was bail and quickly. Like, that was the...
And your note was probably after, you didn't bail quick enough.
Yeah, you needed to get out of there because that was not funny or
right.
good. And I think that was how I responded.
And then they're like, well, what could I have done next time? Be funnier. Okay, next.
No. Yeah, so, I think it was a little bit of that.
But even through that train wreck, you wanted to be a director.
Mm-hmm. I did. I like shaping material. I like being a part of that process. It fulfills, acting is fun and I still enjoy it, but directing fulfills another part that is much more, I feel like, sustainable, at least for me. I like to watch the little idiosyncratic things that happen within a scene. I like to see the choices that they're making. As a director, I feel like I'm on stage with
You don't. There's never like, because I've directed improv and stuff like that. And sometimes when you're there, you're like, God, I wish I was up there. You know, like, it's kind of hard to separate that.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost a jealousy. There is a jealousy. Do you ever feel that when you're directing?
Like, I don't. I'm very much outside of that. I feel like I am empathetically with them. That's why sometimes it's very hard for me to watch things. I'm like, there's a lot of, for the few listeners, I was just like waving my hands around.
Right. Right. And I'm going to guess that it was a lot of anxiety, lot of frustration watching that process.
Sometimes there's a lot of me walking around and trying to get, like, I mean, yeah. But I'm also like, only because I want to, I feel like I'm on a ride when I'm watching them.
You know, Ed Garza, you know, at Second City, he said to me years ago when I was teaching there, and we would put up like a Level D show, which was a 15-minute short form show with the students. He'd say, I remember seeing him in the hall before I was putting the show up, and I go, I am so nervous. I don't understand why I'm nervous. And he said, because the director takes on the fear and the nervousness mm-hmm. for the performers. Do you experience that?
I do, or at least you absorb it. I want the people that I work with to feel, this is going to sound lofty as hell. I want to like...
We'll let it fall off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I want, whenever a performer gets up on stage and I'm directing them, I want them to feel like they can take whatever chance that they can, and they can take whatever risk that they want to, and that at least one person in the audience is on their side and is there with them. Like, I want them to know that it's like they're perfectly safe to do that.
How do you create that?
I like putting people in situations where, like, I have two games that I do pretty consistently. They're which I don't always do, but oftentimes I will. They're ball games, keeping the ball in the air and then passing the ball around the circle in a pattern. And it actually helps to make it like really playful. Every time they have an idea, even if it's a bit they're doing, I'm like, do you want to try that? Is that something you really want to try? Because I'm with you. If you want to do it, I'll do. And then I'm just sort of like, yeah, let's. If you wanted to do that bit that you did that was just kind of a joke, and they're like, oh, that was a joke, but I.
And then you'll go to a suitcase with balls and give
them
balls.
Yeah, and you have balls and they play with it. Right. And so it's a lot. I try to maintain a very playful environment.
So for people that listen to the podcast, because this goes all over the world, mm-hmm. Tell us a little about the game that you do simply with the ball.
So the first, it's very poetically called Ball One.
it's pending the trademark. I just want people to know that.
So I get a ball. For a while, with kickballs, which are heavy.
Those big, round, red kickballs?
Like dodgeballs. Torture balls. But I don't anymore. But these are like very, just like the character balls you can buy at Walgreens. And the goal is the ensemble gets around, and everybody, they hit the ball. They're trying to keep the ball in the air. And every time anybody hits the ball, they're counting upwards. So like 1, 2, 3, 4. And if the ball hits the ground, they have to start over. Everybody counts all at the same time. So not one person is counting, but everybody is. You can hit the ball more than once to get it back into play, because your only job is to keep the ball in the air and also keep control of the ball. What will happen oftentimes, especially in the first time that we do this, is like ball up in the air, and then people are like, 5, 6, 7, and then the ball hits the ground almost immediately. But if they're like, oh, we're in control of this, I can keep it up in the air, and then I can send it across intentionally to somebody else in the circle, we've gotten it up to like, over, I think 1,500 is the...
Wow.
yeah. And then you actually have to do improv stuff.
Right.
But like,
if you have time left.
Right.
Three hours.
Yeah, exactly. 3 hours of like, but their arms are like solid.
Right.
But it really focused. You can tell when they're then all in the room together. Because at first it's like, all over the place and nobody's really. But then they get very focused on it, and it's just this very rhythmic, like, we are keeping the ball in the air. And if something unexpected happens, then they're there to take care of it. And it's a very literal, physical, tangible way of saying, you guys are working together to accomplish this goal. And if somebody can't hit the ball all the time very well, you compensate for that because they have strengths other places.
But what does it have to do about being funny?
It means that if somebody is going to take a chance, which is what being funny is taking those risks, that the other people in the group are there to help that chance happen.
You then graduate from DePaul, mm-hmm. All right, and you're feeling pretentious, and you described yourself as having a stick up your ass about what art should be.
Yes.
When you graduated from DePaul, what was your idea of art?
That's a really great question. I think I thought it of being kind of stodgy. I thought it was very fourth wall theater. Like, you sit and you listen. I'm talking. Like that. I think that was kind of that was my idea of it. I don't think I had any sense of it being an alive, active thing. It was very old fashioned. And I'm not sure why, because I came from a teacher who was very risk-taking, and but I think I had this sense of, of audience does this, and I do this. And then I auditioned for Comedy Sports.
Why did you audition for Comedy Sports? Because
my boyfriend didn't call me.
Can you explain that?
So I was I had a boyfriend. This is maybe a little TMI.
There's never too much TMI.
No.
We are known
too
for our TMI.
TMI.
Too much information.
too much information.
Right.
I had a boyfriend at the time, and he was 20. So he didn't call me. And we were, and I was sort of like, well, I'm going to do something else. And a friend of mine was like, well, there's an audition that I saw in Perform Inc. for Comedy Sports. Why don't
Perform
you go to
Inc.
that?
Was the old, it was an actor's newspaper, yes, and they'd have auditions in the back.
Right. And so she, like, we were kind of pouring through that to see if there were any auditions or whatever. And she was like, it's tonight. If he doesn't call, my roommate was like, if he doesn't call, you're going. And I was like, I'm fine, I'll go. And then, like, I went, and I got called back. I was so not good. Like, I was so... Because we've been doing Spolling, which is for process.
Right.
Not any of short-form games stuff. And I was very snobby about, like, what are we doing? You know, like, there was a little bit of that. And then I did... And then I got called back. And the next night, I was just like, I'm still not... Like, and I'm kind of looking around. Everybody's so funny and quick. And I was not quick or funny or smart. Like, everything...
You were a serious actor.
I was a very serious actor. Yes. So kneel before me. I'm a serious actor. But everybody was so smart. And I felt like they were kind of doing magic that I just didn't know how to do. And I would be like, I can pick up a cup.
And they're like, why are we going so fast?
Like, and why are you guys going so fast? Because I have to, like, clean the bag.
You walk through my table. I want to talk to you after the show.
Right.
It took me 10 minutes to set that table up.
I have a room that I've rented. I can show you all this. Yes. So, like, it was... I did... But then we did this exercise called 10 characters in 100 seconds, which I just forced a lot of my students to do recently. And I happened to be good at character work. So I did the 10 characters in 100 seconds, and I think that they were like, okay, we'll hire her. You know, because that was the one funny thing I did the entire time. And then they hired me, and I was just like, fine, I guess I'll do it. Because I was kind of a shithead. Like, I wasn't like, I was just being such a twerp about it.
Well, this was for you. You probably really, really this was an insult almost, right? You looked down on this.
I did.
Right.
I did. I'm ashamed to say.
Okay.
And I was like, fine, I'll do it for 3 months, you know, because that was the minimum that they were asking for. So I did it. I wound up doing it for 3 years.
And you had an epiphany the first time you reffed a Comedy Sports show.
Yes.
And the audience gave you a hard time, and you learned something.
Yes.
Can you tell us?
They tore me up. I was so bad at it. I wasn't good on my feet. I wasn't good at dealing with the audience and being able to make them feel welcome or shape the show for them. And I learned how to make a show work in a very short amount of time. Like, you make them welcome, you get them warmed up, you take care of the audience, and there's this great thing that happens when the audience is really there for you and you're genuinely there for them. Yes, there's tension that happens between an audience and a performer. But the tension is kind of a good thing, especially when you're like, I'm breaking through it, I'm taking control of it, and I'm inviting you in to this experience. And then it's just like, it's so fun and frightening, and I wasn't ready for the frightening part. So I was terrible. And then because of that experience, I got better and I understood. You know, I think that people kind of maybe look down at short-form games a little bit, and it's like, you make a choice, and you have to make a creative choice. And if it's artfully done, it's extraordinary. And I've seen really artfully done things at Comedy Sports before. I've seen people do fun, cool, smart, engaging stuff that made the audience, like, go to their feet because they were invited in. And I think that it taught me a lot about what the audience's role is for us as entertainers and performers.
What is the audience's role?
To be witness, to be engaged, to feel less alone, to commune. Like, and that sounds kind of lofty, but it's like, I believe that about the power that theater has when it's done in a way that is like, come with me. But if it's not, then it's just like, oh, it's boring. You know? And I think a lot of times an audience...
And how are those things that you picked up at Comedy Store to include the audience? that you've now used in your directing, like when you directed Apes of Wrath at ETC, the second city?
There was a ton of audience interactivity with that.
I mean, is it simple as that? Just get the audience involved and do, you know...
Getting like literal audience interactivity, but then also knowing how to listen for when they're not into it. Knowing how to get them on board with the show. The show was an odd show, I think. It had a lot of weirdness to it and a lot of kind of surreality. And so because of that, it needed some stair steps along the way to get the audience to be like, oh, this is funny. So I like making sure that they were laughing right away and that they understood that this was, I'd pay for a comedy show and a comedy show I shall get. because sometimes it's like that if you make it wait for a laugh, they're sort of like, what am I, this was supposed to be, we have a babysitter.
Right.
You know, so I think that part of that was also like they're inviting them in that way, like making them laugh right away. And then like, okay, you like that? Let's look at this other stuff too. But also even if they didn't like the artsy stuff for it being artsy, they could also enjoy it for the other thing that it is, which is just funny. So I think that it's important to, open the door for the audience. And sometimes they want to be spanked a little bit. Like, sometimes you want to spank the audience. They deserve it, if they want it.
What do you mean by spank the audience?
I don't know. Sometimes they're rowdy, or like, they're like, you're being funny! You know, like, they get, and then if you know how to handle it, then the audience is like, yay! I was bad, and you
right.
taught me better!
Right. Like, and I'll behave for the next 45 minutes.
Exactly. They want to challenge you. And I think that there's, like, we fear challenge.
Which is interesting, because backstage you said to me, you struggle with authority, and that's why you like teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same way, you know. I feel the same way. It's funny, the relationship, because really, a show or a performance, they are the authority, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we come as an audience.
Yes, but they also don't want to be pandered to, you know? Like, they want to be challenged. But sometimes they just don't know the way in which they want to be challenged. And I think that it's hard to make that invitation really impactful for an audience, if that makes sense. And so I think that it's easy, we can get them to laugh. And getting them to laugh helps like sort of ease them into the theatrical experience.
So let's get these people to laugh, because we're going to improvise now.
Okay.
And you are known for character. Okay, I am not known for characters. Characters scare the hell out of me, but I would like to do a character since you're here. So give me a little advice on playing characters.
Can I ask first what you struggle with as far as characters are concerned?
I don't feel like I'm believable as characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So and I get very into my head.
Mm. I think that there are three things. First, you can make a physical choice. And by physical choice, I also mean vocal. So if you make a very strong physical choice and then commit to that physical choice, or if it's just like a pitch thing, if you're like, I'm going to talk like this for the rest of the day, like if that's how you're going to talk, then that, and then maintain it, that helps put you into the brain and body of somebody else a little bit. The other thing is that, you know, you can think of point of view. Like, point of view can be general but played all the time. So, like, if it is, if you're somebody who's, like, their belief about things is, like, I believe that we all die alone. And then that's it. Like, that, and everything that you go through that point of view, it just makes, like, suddenly, like, you could be making balloon animals at a child's Christmas party. Or child's Christmas party, sure. Child's birthday party, making balloon animals, and it's like...
It's not an animal.
You know?
Right.
Like,
it's a pencil.
It's too bad. I can use a bathroom. You know, like, and then, like, and then it's like you have this thing where you're, like, And then you put them in sort of opposition to that. That can help. And you can do that with any point of view, just as long as it's sort of like, I believe this about the world, and then it kind of helps to shape just attitude about everything. that, and you can also give yourself subtext about the other person.
Give me an example.
So, an exercise I like to do is I give like I'll have people start a conversation, and then I give them each a subtext that directs towards the other. So, like for you, I might say like you have like your subtext is that you've been in love with me since the fourth grade.
Okay, great.
And then my subtext is I don't want you to know that I smell.
Okay.
So then we play a scene, and then for the rest of the scene, I'm like trying to make sure that this, and all I know is that I just don't want you to know that I smell. And that kind of helps with the physicality. But then you, like, have this attitude of, like, maybe wanting to be close to me. Maybe talking about what it was like when we were in the fourth grade. And
trying to give you a kiss.
Yeah, you know. Like that kind of stuff. Or, like, even, you know, just especially since that seems like such a long-standing crush not to have been realized. Like, you know, I have a poem I memorized when I was in fourth grade. You know what I mean? Like, so then it helps to engineer a character that you can sort of build a framework around rather than it being.
Great. So we're going to take a suggestion, and then we're going to see if we can put any of this into play.
Okay.
All right? What do you like to start with in terms of suggestion?
I think I like a
That's your water.
That's my... A phrase.
Okay, phrase. Could we get a phrase, please?
Snap it to a Slim Jim.
Pardon?
Snap into a Slim Jim.
Snap into a Slim Jim. So what comes to you in terms of doing it as a character?
Are we doing it now?
Yeah, we're going to do it now.
Are we getting it up?
We're going to get up, but okay. We're going to just talk about the process. Just for a second. I thought you were like going into a trance.
I'm
going to
like...
I was like, oh my God, she really thinks really hard. Right.
And like, right. There's my character. That was very weird. I just did that.
Snap into a stimp.
Snap into a slip. So there are several things that I do when I... You mean when I get a suggestion?
Yes.
I start to free associate off of it like in terms of like symbolically what it can mean. Or a, you know, for like, I think of... Who is the guy who was like, snap into a Slim Jim?
The Macho Man.
Was it Macho? Thank you. It was, so like, thinking about like somebody who might be really into wrestling.
Okay.
Or like, and start, like starting to think about the likes and dislikes associated with that. And like, you know, where I was the last time I had a Slim Jim, which was probably throwing up in the backseat of my parents' car. Like that kind of stuff. The throwing up might have been predicated by the Slim Jim. I kind of went off on a flight of fancy. So,
I love how like so many ideas are in your head
yeah.
so quickly.
Yeah. I'm funny. No, I'm terrified
you.
Of improvising.
Are you really terrified of
yeah.
improvising? What scares you about it? You haven't done it in a while?
Oh, sure. I mean, might there be... But I'm always terrified. I've never
For as long as you've done it, you are always terrified.
There's never been a time I've not been terrified. So... You're welcome, kids. It will always be frightening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you have a character from all the stuff that you've gone through?
Just now?
Yes.
I can. Do you want me to do it now?
I don't know. I mean, it's up to you. I'm trying to think. For me, it's like, okay, I hear Slim Jim, and I think I could be really tall. Okay, that's what I think. This is pathetic. This is my problem. And then I think, okay, then the other thing I think is like Slim Jims. It's made of beef. So I could be kind of like a muscle head kind of guy. And then I think, oh, Slim Jims. Who eats Slim Jims? I think of people, you know, like from the South. We like a Slim Jim, you know. I don't have time for dinner. I'm going to get Slim Jim at the convenience store. So I've got all these things. So how do I just pick one? And so then when I throw those three out, I say to myself, you know what? They're all very cartoony. They're all not very believable. They're not being honest.
I think that starting from a place of, because for me, I immediately go into, well, who would be eating Slim Jims, or who, like, because I was also thinking about like, well, in regards to you, like if I was like, you know, I packed Slim Jims in your lunch every day this week, and you brought every single one of them back home. I bought those special for you. And you can't you can't give me the respect to eat them or at least trade them away so I don't know and get my feelings hurt. What do you think your daddy would say?
I think he'd say he'd be real disappointed.
He'd be real disappointed in you. At least think about the effect your behavior might have on your mama. I could use those. I mean, sure, I'll use them in a casserole or something if you bring them home. But I don't. I just don't think you see me fully as a mother, as a human being. You might see me as a mama, and that's all. But I'm a person who has feelings inside.
Mama, I would never do anything to hurt you.
You do things to hurt me constantly. It's a consistent... Graham, you hurt me every day, and you don't even know it. You don't even look to see the tears I cry.
I know you cry, Mom, but I didn't think it was about me.
It is.
I thought it's because Daddy left you.
Oh, that bugger. I don't care about him. Don't rock the trailer on the way out. You want an apple?
I'm just going to bring it back.
Maybe you eat the apple right here on the table.
Mama, I'm 19 now. I should be able to pick up my own food.
Well, what would you pick?
I would pick something from the vending machine. One of those cereal bars.
That is nothing but carbohydrates and sugar, and it's going to do nothing but give you breakouts. How are you going to be able to ask out Laura Jane if you got none of the breakouts? I'm trying to get you married, honey. You can't just live here at home with me all the time. If you go, I'm glad you're going to the community college. But you got to settle down with a girl you like. Or, oh no, do you like, are you... Are you gay, honey?
Yeah, Mom.
Is that why you don't like Slim Jims?
Yeah. I didn't want to tell you.
I know. Is it because you think I'm gonna whoop you?
Yeah.
I'm struggling because I want to. But I don't... I love you, sweetheart.
I love you too, Mom. But sometimes I think that Jesus comes in between us.
You mean that Jesus? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were talking about the Jesus who works at the...
No, Mom, that's Jesus.
I call him Jesus.
Yeah.
We're in America.
I know. Yeah, I understand.
Because I wouldn't mind dating Jesus. The one that works at the...
Right. Right.
Do you like another? So, Laura Jane, you don't care for her.
No, I never did.
Oh. All right. Do you like her brother? I mean, they're good stock people. I want to make sure that we're... That
no, you're I'm not going. Interested in Bill. He's not my type.
You have a type.
Mom, this is very uncomfortable. I didn't... You're smoking? You haven't smoked in, since Daddy left.
That you've seen.
You've been lying. You're the one who always tells me don't lie, and that's why I told you the truth.
Should be ashamed that I started again.
I'm not ashamed, Mom. I'm disappointed. You're the one who always tells me, don't lie. If you lie, you're going to go to hell. That's what the Bible says.
It is.
I think I'm going to go.
To your accounting class or just go?
No, I'm going to go to Cale's house, my boyfriend.
What is his name?
Cale.
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 K-A-L-E.
K-A-L-E.
Yeah. Like the stuff you eat?
People don't eat that. Do you like, I mean, do you eat, Do you eat kale the vegetable?
Yes, Mom, I do.
Maybe I should buy some. If I buy some, will you eat it?
Sure. I'd like you to meet him. Did you burn yourself there,
yes,
Mama?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I got some aloe vera in the refrigerator if you want. Takes the sting right out.
Did Cale tell you that?
Yeah. It says aloe vera.
I've been putting a little squirt of that in the casserole.
Let me help you, Mama. Sorry, Daddy left you. I think you're much prettier than Priscilla.
Her nose is pretty big.
Thank you, Mama.
You still, okay.
We can hug?
We can hug.
You weren't going to hug me?
I didn't know if there was a difference between you being, like, if it's a gay hug or if it was, if you were pretending to be, like, a regular, I mean, come here.
No, I don't want to hug you, Mama. You got to accept me for who I am.
I got to work on it.
Well, when you're done working on it, give me a call. Because I'm not going to stay around here.
Okay.
Other people know.
Does Jesus know?
All right. Okay. So, what's so funny?
Oh, that's so fun.
That was a lot of fun. So, the first thing is, I read it off you. So you go, you know, to my character, is he gay? To the son. And I'm thinking to myself, based on how you said it, I'm like, and the pauses and stuff, I'm like, let's just go with the agreement. Mm-hmm. Is that what was in your head?
Yes, I was ready for, if it was a denial, like, I did not, there was a genuine discovery. Like, I didn't know that that was necessarily what the scene was.
Right, well, I don't, and certainly it wasn't clear at the beginning.
Sure.
But there was that hesitation of, do you want to go with, I don't know, what was the girl's name at the
time? Laura Jean.
Laura Jean. And then there was this pause, and then you turned that pause into...
Yes.
Right.
Right. I think that it was a, you know, when you said yes, I don't necessarily, like, if you had said no, mm-hmm. it would have been okay. Mm-hmm. I think that we would have just found something else. I was glad that you said yes. Because
well, then, I just thought it was easiest, plus...
And saying, yeah.
Plus, the way you had tipped your hand to it. Mm-hmm. Had you not tipped your hand, I thought, well, but it was so... It was so clear how you were playing it that's how, in that moment, that's how it would have gone.
Yeah.
You know? So I thought that was really a good move, mm-hmm. you know? And I wish I would have got, you just, like, talk about act. I mean, you brought all your acting to it. It was so much fun to work off of you, you know? Because every moment was like, it was like really important. You know, mm-hmm. and this woman was so I was thinking to myself, okay, I'm just gonna like, and I wish I would have done it quicker, maybe, just given her more things to struggle with, her son's, you know, her son who's gay.
I liked
the slowness of it.
I did, okay. Because it was like getting to the, you mean getting to the whether or not you were gay, that like the lead up.
No, afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought the son's gay. I thought that was a great discovery.
Yes.
But I thought, okay, let's turn the heat up on you a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think that making me have to, like, you... I liked how you didn't let me off the hook.
Right.
Because I think sometimes that can be, like, it's like, well, let's resolve this.
Right, but you also, your choice of the character, you were struggling with it, which I thought was great, you know?
But you also weren't telling me, I don't know, you weren't acquiescing.
Right.
Which I liked. I was like, and I liked the fact that you were like, I'm going to go stay with my boyfriend.
Right.
You know?
Well, I thought, hey, let's stick it
right.
to the mom.
And I thought there were some, like, I thought we set some, like, genuine moments of sweetness, of, like, mm-hmm. really accepting. I also liked that we didn't just hate each other.
Right.
Which can sometimes be.
Right. Well, that's one that I always struggle with, because I like to play the, I hate you, you know, it's an easy one to play.
Well, and it can be fun.
Right.
But I think also, like, I feel like we loved each other.
Yeah. Yes.
Which
yes.
But loving somebody and struggling with who they are, I think, is compelling.
Right. And also, underneath, you know, you'll have fight, you know, on a foot, you know, you have fights with people that you love, mm-hmm. you know? And they can be knocked down, dirty fights, but underneath it, there's love. And you get, I got the sense at the end of the scene that they were, you know, that they were going to reconcile. It mm-hmm. wasn't like, I'm never coming back, oh, fuck you. It was like, okay, I'm uncomfortable with it. And your character had nothing, you know, like in terms of her life. She had this son. It was so sad.
God. Everything about it was just like so tragic.
Which I love. I love dark and tragic.
But I think that again, like having that, the tragedy of it is...
Right.
It helped to... I mean, characters have tragedies associated right. with them. It kind of depends on how you want to play it.
Right.
To make... If it's going to be funny or if it's, you
now,
know...
Now, this wasn't picked up at all on the podcast that people are listening, but you did incredible object work, and I was just basically, you know, like, I'm playing a 19-year-old, you know, kind of thing. I'm going to sit in the chair again. So,
what?
It was hard for me. It was really hard, you know?
Just to be there?
Just to be there, you know, to play the character, to, you know, like, what's my point of view? I mean, it was hard, you know? And was I really 19, you know? I didn't, you know, I don't know. But I did the best I possibly could.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was fun to play off because you
were
so... Oh,
I love playing with you.
You were so, like, you know, we were trying to find it, you
yeah.
know? And I felt, and this is something that I think is really necessary. At least it's necessary for me as a performer. I need to know that the other person is interested in going... wherever it is we're going to go, mm-hmm. and we don't know where it's going to be. And I think that that's hard.
Yes.
I think, because I'm also worried that, like, I want to be a good partner for you.
Right.
And, like, I think that it's hard to take the hand of somebody else and say, I have no idea, so let's go,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of submit to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can be hard because it takes a tremendous amount of trust. You were very easy to trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Okay. Anything you do different in this scene?
Anything I would do differently?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It's hard. Like, I probably, I might try to make her, like, give her something to live for. Like, you know, I think I could make it, I don't know if I would let her be so soft.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I feel like I wanted her to be a little bit harder. But I wanted her to be, I didn't want her to be pathetic. And so sometimes I think that sometimes, like, with my softer, lower status characters, there can be a sense of, like, really am I getting low status?
Well, the thing I loved is the status changed. You had high status at the beginning, and then the son got the high status at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was interesting is, at the beginning, you went right into it. Usually we get up and we do it. You went right into the scene. And I'm thinking, I want to play the, you know, the muscle head guy. But I'm like, that, I don't think that would, I had to, that was my first choice. And I threw that away, and I'm like, okay, she's playing the Southern character. We've talked about the Southern character. Let's just go into the Southern character.
Yeah, I hope it was okay that I just kind of launched right into it.
I'm like, let's do it, you know? That's usually the best, because it forces you out of your comfort zone. You're like,
yes.
Fuck.
There is a sense of, like, there is a sense of getting out of your head, getting out of my head. Because I find this in Freeze too. People kind of wait for the right moment, and that right moment won't ever happen if you're waiting to orchestrate whatever that right moment is. It has to be the impulse.
So what's the secret for you playing Freeze Tag?
Just clap and get out there. And I don't always do it very well, because I am waiting for that moment that will be like, oh, this is good, kill.
Right.
And then it's just like it never happens. So then I think I just have to be like. And then I have to get out there because it terrifies me.
That is the worst thing. When you have that, you see the freeze, or you think you're going to say a line, and you're like, this is going to kill, and it doesn't, and you're like on a 2-second delay, you're like, where's the laughter? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's the worst feeling in the world. It's like 3 seconds of, like,
yes.
it's like a root canal. I mean, it's like the worst, like, tooth
yes.
pain. You know? You're like, oh my, I'm dying here.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's like, and then you're left, and you said the funny thing, the capital F funny thing, and then you get out there, and then nobody's laughing, and everybody hates you because you ended the scene before, that not on a laugh, you left them out there for too long, you went out there and said your crap thing, and then everybody's like, well, now we have no scene
right.
because you said something funny, and there's nothing happening.
Right.
That is the worst.
Okay, so let's take some questions from the audience. Can we turn the lights on, Sam? Yes, Tom.
Hi, Jen. I want to ask how you guys came up with the Drunk Monkey Show.
The Drunk Monkey Show. How did you come up with it?
My friend Erica Reed Gertis and I have a podcast called Drunk Monkeys, and we test weird liquors. It came from... I have been obsessed with DiSerono commercials.
What commercials?
DiSerono commercials.
What are those?
They're so weird. It's just like some guys behind a bar that only apparently sells DiSerono. And
so that's
then,
a liquor?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like an amaretto.
Okay.
And then and the commercials are just like bizarre alien interpretations of human behavior. And I was obsessed with it. I was like, I wonder what DiSerono tastes like. Well, I'm going to get some DiSerono and I'm going to taste it. And Eric was like, you can't just do that by yourself in your apartment alone. That would be so sad. And so we bought a whole bottle of DiSerono. We went to a restaurant and they were like, yeah, we have DiSerono behind the bar. We could have. And so now I think we still have that bottle of DiSerono. And so we drank it, and then we talked about it, and we talked about what could go in it. And then we just decided maybe it would be funny if we filmed drinking horrible. Sometimes it's stunt drinking. Sometimes it's genuine like cocktail culture stuff. But we just started filming ourselves stunt drinking these awful things, and then the rest is history.
Several podcasts, like several shows in a row. It's like by the third show, it's pretty well kicking in at that point.
Yeah, we're hole in the bag, as it were.
Hole in the bag. What do you mean?
Drunk.
Oh, you're drunk. Yeah. All right, let's get another question here. Yes, back here.
It's kind of a two-part question. You said when you were 16 that you knew you wanted to direct. Did you ever think it would have been like? Did you know you wanted to do theater, or did you ever consider film? And then like.
Let's ask the first one.
Sure.
I got to repeat it. At 16, you knew you wanted to direct, but you ever think you wanted to get into film? Is that the question?
Yeah, like how did you know theater, or did you even know?
I think I had it in my head that I was going to be a film director.
Not a theater director.
I wanted to be a theater director too, but I didn't know enough to really separate the two in my head. So I think I just wanted to direct people to do things. So but theater was much more accessible to me at the time. I didn't have to go through film school. We don't have, like, I could film something on my phone.
Today.
And right now and have it released by Touchstone. You know, like, if I, right. not, I mean, no. But, like, you know what I mean? It's much more democratic than it was before. So I think I just stuck with theater because it was more available to me than other stuff.
What was your second part of your question?
My second question was, like, knowing what you wanted to be so young, I feel like there had to be some kind of strong influence. Like, did you have favorite movies or directors that really, or shows that really, like, inspired you to become a director?
What were your inspirations growing up? Movies, TV shows, people?
It's so interesting, because PB, the woman who I, because, like, she was the director of Oliver.
Peggy Boren.
Yes, she was my director from the time I was 11 until I graduated.
She directed you in community theater?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So watching her direct, my sister also directed, and so seeing those people create something really helped me. And then on the other end of it, like, I wanted to be Robin Williams. It was funny because, like, I was right after he died, we were talking about influences, and I was like, he was probably one of the single biggest influences on me as a comedian. He hadn't gone to the decline yet in terms of, like, how we kind of perceived him as our somewhat embarrassing dad, you know, who was still funny, but also just like, oh, dad. But he was a genius. Like, the way his brain worked, I wanted to be funnier than him. Like, I wanted to be also a woman who was funnier than he was. So I really, like, I watched him a lot. But I don't think I necessarily made the connection between directing theater and comedy until much later.
You know, when you directed the review Apes of Wrath, the Second City ETC, you described it as the most rewarding and the most challenging experience of your career.
Mm-hmm.
What was challenging about it, and what was rewarding about it?
The challenge was making sure it was funny and smart and good. I mean, I think that's kind of a general answer, but it was like, whenever a new scene would go up, and it would be the thing I want it to be, and I would watch it, and I would just be like, oh, it's not there. And you can't see the show as a whole. You're sort of going, you're like, you set sail, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and sometimes the seas are very rocky, and sometimes there's a lighthouse, and then you crash into the lighthouse. There's all kinds of things that can happen. There are cast dynamics. This cast was amazing. They were supportive and wonderful. They were a fantastic ensemble. But I sort of likened it to, you know, you can know something's on the other side of a wall, and you jump to see what's on the other side of the wall, but you can't, you see it for a split second, and then you have to jump back down. So it's like, and like every night when I would put a new thing in the show, it would be like, oh, I see you. Oh, no, and it's terrible, and I hate everything, I hate myself, and, you know, I didn't jump high enough or long enough, and it's terrible. And so that's what it was like. And my husband, who's here, can attest to this, like, I would just be like, I don't know. And then the next night it would be amazing. I'd be like, it is, I know. I was right all along. And then the, yeah.
How did you go from the thing of like the night where you come home and it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. How did, what did you do to get back to the next rehearsal where you're like, okay, this is what we're going to do? Because what brought your spirits up? Or?
Taking control of my vision and making choices. I think that that is, can always be hard, and also recognizing the mistakes. Like, there was one night where I totally just burnt my running order. Like, it was terrible. Like, I rearranged the running order because I was trying some stuff, and it was awful. It was one of the worst nights ever, and I was just like, and they were like, I went backstage and they were like, oh my god, we open in a week. This is, I mean,
the white face,
everybody,
fear.
And I went backstage, and I also did it from in front of Kelly Leonard. He came to see the show that night, and
who
was
the producer at the time,
yes.
Or president? Yeah.
And he was just like, he couldn't even give me notes. It was so bad.
Did you think it was over at that point?
I wondered a little
right.
bit. I don't think it was fireable, but there was part of me that was just like, I'm never working anywhere, ever, in the city, on the continent, again.
Right.
It was terrible. Like, you could see it from space. It was so awful.
Right.
And then I went backstage, and they were just like a huddled mess. It was terrible. And I said, guys, it was not you. This was me. We're going to fix it. And so the next night, I rearranged running order, put it back, restored it to the time when it was the funniest, and it killed. And I went backstage, and they were like, oh, thank God. Oh, my gosh. And knowing I made a mistake, I screwed it up in a very public way. And then to be like, okay, I have to make some choices here.
Why was that important to go back there and tell them, I fucked up, it was my mistake?
I don't believe in making people think that they're the ones when I was the one that did it. Like, knowing the level of responsibility and knowing what that line is very important to me. And if there are things that my action did a thing, then and it caused failure or problems or whatever, then I need to be able to say, I did this thing, I tried it, I don't think it was the right thing, I would like to try something else that I know will work. And I think that there is something to taking ownership over those kinds of choices, because you have to. You have to make choices, and you have to be like, I'm the one that made the choice. And I think it gives you a lot of, it opens you up to a lot of criticism, or, you know, and a lot of potential, like, well, why, you know, if you made this choice that failed, why should we trust you again? Totally understandable. But at the very least, I said, I made that choice.
We've got to wrap this up. This has just been so much fun. We could go on for another hour easily because we haven't even gotten this stuff, but we got to go. Yeah, my wife is saying, we've got to go, right, Lauren? She's shaking her head. You're right.
We have a reservation.
Yes. We've got a Lincoln Town Car picking us up, and so we'll go to the Four Seasons for dinner. You're right, our reservation. We end all the podcasts the same way. What one piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
I would say get as much stage time as you can. Take classes and be willing to learn. And embrace the level of failure that is surely going to come your way. And I like, because it is. And know that without taking the chances and without taking those risks, you won't get better. You have to be able to, like, fine, I'm going to take a class today. I'm going to do the thing that I'm afraid of doing. I'm going to get up there. I'm going to clap and do in the freeze that I know I'm terrified of. I'm going to do that one thing. I'm going to take that one chance. And it might blow up in your face. It likely will. But you have to be able to, like, okay, it blew up in my face. What did I get from that? And just do it. Just do that.
You're excited when you describe, oh, blow up in your face. There's an excitement. Do you love? Is there a part of you that really loves failing?
Love is maybe not the right word. It's exhilarating to fail. And because what was interesting about the night that I was telling you about, where I basically just blew up my whole running order.
Right.
Was how weirdly, I was talking about my assistant director at the time, Tyler Dean Kemp, and I was like, I'm weirdly okay. I felt very serene, maybe psychotically so, because it was just like, it can't get worse. And I know what I have to do now. If I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have known. So now I do. And it was exciting that the moments following the awful, humiliating failure, the moments following were exciting.
We got to wrap this up.
I'm
just having too much time. But is it fair to say that a lot of times the darkest, deepest, like, oh my God, what am I doing? What, you know, when you admitted you made a mistake, that a lot of the times something great happens the next day or the next week or.
Yeah, there's a great Winston Churchill quote, which is, "If you're going through hell, keep going," and that's true. If hell is all around you, something's got to be on the other side of it, and it might be different than what's happening now. So if you keep on going, then eventually it will change.
That is good news for my career, because I've been going through hell for the last 30 years. Jen Ellison, thank you so much. Wow, this is cool.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, and I want to thank our guest, Jen Ellison. And especially, I love what you talked about, making mistakes and going back to her cast at ETC after a night of flop sweat. And she said, you know what? The running order, it was my mistake. I thought that was it was a really good thing that I need to remember. I'd also like to thank our home base here, the people that treat us like such rock stars, and that is Stage 773 here in Chicago. Also, my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, or to sign up for my Improv Nerd blog, every week I'll send you out a new blog that will not only make you a better improviser, but make you a better person. Well, the better person is up to you. Go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, we're taking over social media. We've been doing that for the last 4 years, if you've noticed or not. Like us on Facebook, Improv Nerd. Then follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd. And then go to our Improv Nerd channel and see clips from our live shows. That's Improv Nerd Podcast on YouTube, Improv Nerd Podcast. We're also lucky enough to be part of a podcast collective called Feral Audio. That's feralaudio.com. Check all the other hilarious and innovative podcasts on feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank our sponsors today, Utter Nonsense, The Party Game, and the 7th Annual Dallas Comedy Festival. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my